from the cheerfully chatty studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another talkative hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, but I'm about to take a powder and turn the show over to our fearless producer, James Zipro, and our awesome ninja, Sean, and they are going to discuss their favorite phone calls from 2025. So hang in there, cats and kittens. There's lots of talking to come. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
WDIY has been broadcasting since 1995.
This is Mayor Ken Smith. Congratulations to WDIY for signing on the air.
We're with Commissioner Frank Donches of the Bethlehem Police Department.
We welcome Dr. John on the blend today.
Bob Durow composed, conducted, and played much of the Schoolhouse Rock music.
Three is a magic number.
Weapons and antidote to violence is to speak up against them.
WDIY for 30 years.
From the still festive studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for another hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and in this week's edition of In the News, we feature a story that combines Halloween and Christmas traditions from other nations, each featuring a humble and underutilized vegetable, which we are calling Celebrate Two Holidays with Turnips. A New York Times story that ran in local papers a few days before Christmas featured a large photo of a turnip being carved in an attempt to win some serious prize money in Oaxaca, Mexico, where the turnip carving contest dates back 120 years. We'll get back to that story in a moment, but I have to stop here and recount research I did decades ago after hearing that the original jack-o'-lanterns were large turnips carved at Halloween in the UK, especially in my ancestral Ireland, where they didn't know about pumpkins, but were famous for having a climate that grew exceptional root crops. Thus, large turnips were prized for carving into lanterns that resembled the one the original Jack carried as he roamed the countryside. Jack was said to have been a blacksmith who made an unholy deal with the devil and was thus banned from entering heaven. But the devil didn't want him either, and Jack was cursed to roam the countryside with the nighttime help of light from a devil's lantern, a large turnip into which had been carved a hideous face, lit from the inside by a candle or burning coal. Look up Irish jack-o'-lanterns online, and you'll see that these creations were much more frightening than any of our Halloween carved pumpkins. Back to Oaxaca and a very different holiday. As Times reporter James Wagner relates, every December 23rd, this city in southern Mexico comes to a near standstill for a simple vegetable as crowds gather for the annual Night of the Radishes, where locals transform the root vegetables into extravagant works of art. This year, he explains, the intricate carvings included nativity scenes, Days of the Dead displays, and depictions of indigenous mythology. What began as local vendors decorating their vegetable and fish stands at a Christmas market evolved into a contest back in 1897. The radish became the official medium because it was abundant and easy to carve. A state decree protects the yearly event, and the city provides 12 tons of radishes, all for free, to the participants, But that's not the only thing Oaxaca provides. Carvings that receive first place are awarded the equivalent of $1,500, with other cash awards extending all the way down to 20th place. Any resident of Oaxaca can compete, and there is no entry fee. But there are those generous cash prizes. This year's winner, Jose Domingo Loria Aquino, who together with his family carved a replica of the city's outdoor fish and vegetable market, came home on winter break from college in Chicago to compete and has, quote, vowed to defend his title next year.
DIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the 2025 Best of Calls episode of You Bet Your Garden from the fairly festive studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I'm Mike's mildly merry assistant, Sean, and today producer James and I have stolen the reins from Mike for the holidays to bring you a hand-picked bushel of our favorite phone calls from this year, including a two-part call and question of the week. So sit back, grab some nog, and enjoy this very merry montage. For our first call is a rare one that stumped Mike with these odd growths on Ronald's tiger lilies, and we may just have what Ronald needs in this episode's question of the week.
610-694-8100. Ronald, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike, for having me.
Well, thank you for being had, Ronald. Where are you?
I'm located in Burlington County. That's Zone 6.
Right near the Burlington-Bristol Bridge, right?
That is correct. And also Fort McGuire, Fort Dix military base. We're literally 5 minutes away.
Okay. Well, if you need a tank, it'll get there in a hurry. What can we do you for?
We have these tiger lilies, and I believe I shared with you some photographs where we have these little pods. They almost look like large black pepper beads or raisins, which have attached themselves to the tiger lilies. And we started using some Felsnapter and a product called Dettol, which is a universal application for primarily medical purposes, cleaning, sanitation in the healthcare world. And they now seem to be soft because they were hard round balls which gathered at the top of the tiger lily, and now they seem to be falling off. I did cut one open, a number of them open, actually.
Good.
And they're soft inside, creamy, lime green, with a small membrane, and that's about it. Just trying to keep them off the tiger lilies.
Well, you know, tiger lilies are wild day lilies. They're another one of these wonderful plants that's been called invasive. But I love them. They're on the road across from my house. And they bloom more reliably than cultivated daylilies. So I do remember your photographs, and we had a little bit of a back and forth about this issue. But as I told you, I tried to search this every which way, and I could find no reference. I couldn't find it listed as a day lily pest or problem. I tried to run it through insect identification and came up totally blank. So I'm going to talk to you more about what you found inside. And you sent a beautiful picture of these things on your daylily stem. And yes. I said they look like small black jelly beans.
Yep, that's another way of describing them.
Yeah, and, you know, quite frankly, they didn't look bad. If you didn't know better, you might think they were part of the plant. But now, before we get to that, I want to ask you a question. You say they're falling off now. Have they damaged the daylilies in any way?
No, not at all. In fact, when you mentioned the regularity of them, of the tiger lily coming up, they're now, the tiger lilies are now 4 and 5 feet tall.
Huh.
They're huge, and they've got beautiful buds, orange, beautiful orange or volcano orange buds, which opened up. But the black raisins,
yeah,
pods, some of them are still there, but they have definitely, instead of having to rake them off, you can just literally tap it and they'll fall off.
So even if they're not at the top and ready to fall, all you got to do is touch it?
Yes, and I have to, only because of applying either the Felsnapter or the Dettol, which are, again, both biodegradable. That's the only reason why I can come to that they are falling off.
Well, I've heard of a lot of folk cures, but I've never heard Felsnaptha being
okay.
used as, I'm presuming we're looking at some kind of an insect, because if there's no scar on the plant, there's no interaction going on. They might be eggs. I would try to collect some and just put them in a screened box and see if anything comes out eventually, because I am darn curious about this. So they don't seem to be causing a problem. And as I said, they look, you know, highly ornamental to me.
We were concerned that they might also attack. We have Pyrenees in that same flower bed. We have tulips, the hyacinths, and I'm not sure, I didn't do a timeline, but they didn't really blossom very well this year.
Well,
so I'm not
you
sure.
and I I'm both sure. got a severe drought at the end of winter. I mean, 2 months of drought. And now we're being flooded every other day. A township right near me got 8 inches in an hour. The road outside was raging whitewater. It was one of the worst I've ever seen. So, you know, some of these plants are going to react to these stresses.
Yes.
I think I said on a previous show, if something goes wrong in your garden this year, I think you're not at fault. You know, it's climate, and the climate gets weirder and weirder all the time. And they're not on those other plants, right?
No, they're not. They're not gathering. I will, though, to your point earlier, I will take a closer look at those that we've already scraped off, or perhaps scrape some new ones and see if there's any footprint, for want of a better term, between the little black raisins and the tiger lilies. I will take a closer look. I didn't look at it that closely when I did take them off.
You know, unless you get lucky, you're not going to find any reference to this, because I searched the heck out of it. Now, the ones you cut open, had they dropped or did you tap them off?
No, the ones I cut open initially, I had to kind of rake off. But since then, every week I've gone back, and as I mentioned, as I tap the tiger lily, a few will fall off.
Okay, so you may accidentally have succeeded in smothering them using the Felsnapter, because it's soap. And
you
may have created your own semi-natural insecticidal soap. Okay. So you know what to do. I really can't speak to it. I didn't even know they made Phil's naphtha anymore. My mother used to use that for the laundry when I was 10 years old.
I was about to say we're the old school people.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, we use the vinegar and all these, you know, pharma, you know, methods. But they're safe, they're clean, because we have our emotional support dogs. We have lots of other animals. So we have to be careful.
All right. Before I let you go, let's discuss a little bit about what you found inside. Was the inside filled with liquid? Was it mostly hollow?
It was a bit like an avocado, where when I cut the shell, which was a little crispy, it seemed to have a membrane.
Mm-hmm.
No liquid came out. I think some of the pictures I shared with you, I showed you that I had cut them open, but you couldn't necessarily see any kind of liquid forming on the tissue paper.
Okay. Were they solid inside?
No. It was mucous membrane, lime green on the outer side of the inside, and then yellow. And then I believe there was a hollow area.
Okay. The best I can come up with is that they are some sort of insect eggs, but not the eggs of a pest insect. I know they're probably not praying mantis eggs, but I'm thinking of something like that, like stick insects or stuff we don't normally think about. And, you know, the size would seem to be somewhat equal to what you'd expect a praying mantis egg to look like. So I'm going to double down. I really want you to take some of the healthiest ones. But just make a little screened box, just with window screening, and put it in a cool, dry place and check it every once in a while. And you may find things crawling around in there eventually.
I'll see if I can set up one of the little cameras we have with a
there you go.
And see if we can catch.
We'll break the internet.
Yeah.
But cool. You intrigue me. This intrigues me. And I have a feeling we're not done. So stay in touch. And let me know if they do progress into anything. And remember, they're not hurting your plants and they look good.
There you go. Mike, I really appreciate this. And just to let you know, I've been listening to you for at least 20, 30 years when we were living up north in Essex County. And you've always shown us some great ideas, shared some great ideas.
Thank you. You've been there for all of it.
Horticulture is a passion. Thank you.
You can lead a horse to culture, but you can't make him drink. All right. Thank you, Ronald. This is an intriguing conversation, and I will ask anybody out there who has any idea what these things are to get in touch with me, because I need more clues.
To be continued.
Yes. All right. Well, good luck and stay in touch, sir.
Certainly will. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, it's time for us to take a little break, but don't go anywhere because we'll be right back with more of the best phone calls of 2025 and a very special, very related question of the week. I'm your peerless producer, James, teaming up with our awesome assistant, Sean, and you are listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY in Bethlehem, PA.
For the past 3 decades, WDIY has sustained itself through direct contributions from listeners. Our model is simple. The people who listen to the service are the ones who support the service. As WDIY celebrates its landmark 30th anniversary, we invite you to join us as a WDIY member by making a membership gift today. This is something you could do right now to make a meaningful difference in your community. Call 610-694-8100 extension 4 or online at wdiy.org.
Welcome back to a year-end episode of You Bet Your Garden from the NPR studios of WDIY in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. I'm your peerless producer, James, taking the reins of Santa's sleigh with the help of our awesome assistant, Sean, as Mike takes a holiday feast-induced nap. In a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week that solved an ongoing mystery, but first, we're taking a look at some of the best phone calls of 2025. Those calls can be made anytime, by the way, to 610-694-8100, extension number 3.
Our next call comes from the far, far away land of Alaska. Paula is curious about mugwort. No, wait, liverwort in her strawberries.
Paula, welcome back to You Bet Your Garden.
Oh, thank you, Mike.
I have to acknowledge and admit, I've talked about having dyslexia a lot over the years, and some people think I'm kidding around. But no, I've had it all my life. I was like 8 or 9 years old before I could make a 5, which I've always written backwards until a teacher taught me. And you sent us an email about liverwort in your garden. And for some reason, I fixated on a totally different plant called mugwort. And just wasted everybody's time during a taping session. But I know what I'm doing now. You're in Alaska?
Yeah, I live in Southeast Alaska, which is right alongside of British Columbia. We have a maritime climate. It's a temperate rainforest. We get 90 to 100 inches of rain a year, and it never gets warm. It never gets cold. It's just moderate all the time, just really wet. So I have several garden boxes, raised beds. They're foot high and 4 by 14 feet, and it helps raise the soil temperature and improves drainage. But the problem is that one of the boxes that I have strawberries in, and I've got 4 or 5 with strawberries, is it's getting overrun with liverwort. And I've been trying to pick it off, and it just keeps coming back, and now it's just getting worse. I don't know what to do with it.
What you have, liverwort, is kind of a crossover, quote-unquote, plant. It's more like a moss. It's a very weird plant, and it got its name from something called the Doctrine of Similars way back when they were first categorizing plants. If a plant looked like something in your body, the leaves of most varieties of liverwort look like your liver. That was meant as a sign from nature that you should use this plant for liver ailments, which is totally false, of course. But the doctrine of similars is what evolved into homeopathy, which is still active today. So your problem is not so much the plant, but that it's intertwined with strawberries, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how many raised beds do you have?
Probably 10 boxes.
And is the liverwort confined to one?
Yes, just one, thank goodness.
Oh, that shouldn't be bad. And what you're growing in there is strawberries.
Right.
Now, you should be able to grow great strawberries. I know I'm very familiar with Southeast Alaska and the growing conditions. You can grow cabbages the size of a diesel truck, for instance. But most seasons, if not all, you need some sort of structure to get ripe tomatoes and peppers and things like that. But cool season crops, they go wild where you are. And in this case, the fact that you have strawberries makes this not a difficult task. How many years old are the strawberries?
Oh, I replaced them about 2 years ago.
Okay, good, good. Do they, when they send out, quote, daughters, do you do anything with those plants branching off from the mother plant?
Sometimes I'll take those and fill them in places where I don't have any. but I'm not pulling anything out of that box to put in other boxes because I don't want to spread the liverwort.
Oh, no, no. Well, it's not a really invasive, God, I almost hesitate to call it a plant. I'll call it a thing or something like that because it's much more closely related to a moss, which means, of course, in your climate, it is going to thrive. It's in liverwort heaven. So what I suggest you do is reach down into the soil and you have a whole bunch of containers, and those strawberry plants should have grown nicely, but they should still be nicely isolated from each other. So just gently pull them out. I would add pull them out of moist soil, but that's cruel to say to somebody in Southeast Alaska. And the fact that the soil is moist, they'll come out very easily. Pot them up into any kind of containers you can find. This is just temporary. Growing them in containers would be a lot of fun. If you got an old bench or a picnic table, you can put the pots up on there, make the strawberries easier to get at and harder for your slugs, who don't have to work very hard. And then you can literally just pull out the liverwort. Its mossy structure means that many types of its cousin plants don't have actual roots. Like moss, true moss, it'll grow on rocks or wood or something like that. Liverwort is kind of a hybrid in the world of horticulture in that it does have weak rhizomes. So what I want you to do is get those strawberries out of there and pot them up into separate containers right away. Then pull up the liverwort by hand. If it really is covering the whole thing, you should be able to almost roll it up like a carpet. And then just keep an eye on that bed. You don't have to, don't dig in it. Don't disturb the soil any more than you have to. And keep an eye on it for a month. If no new liverwort material appears, then you're golden. It's done with. But if you think those rhizomes still have enough strength to produce new plants, cover that raised bed. And is there room to put a piece of plastic over top, or is the soil above the top of the beds?
No, I can put plastic over it.
Okay. 2 or 3 mil clear plastic and just stretch it over top of the bed. Use rocks or bricks to hold it down on the side. And then when your really long summer days, they should actually be right around the corner, right? Because I was there in April and it didn't get dark till 10 p.m.
Yep, pretty soon.
Yeah, so that's your best chance. You really can't solarize soil in Southeast Alaska or any part of Alaska, but this should be enough. It's a very weak rhizome. It's like a quarter of a root system. So just by isolating it, covering it with plastic, and the plastic will keep rain out, which is good because this thing thrives on moisture. And otherwise, you're going to be out there for a week nonstop with a hairdryer. But I think you can move the strawberries, get rid of the liverwort, and then in my world, I would plant something different in that bed and move the strawberries someplace else. And again, I got slugs too. So little copper flashing or hot glue some pennies around the top of your containers and you'll eat all the strawberries instead of your enormous slugs.
Okay. I'll give that a try.
Yeah, and I know you have slug problems. One of the easiest ways to kind of foil them is to get copper flashing, you know, like you would do around a chimney on a roof. And be careful because it can be very sharp. But just at the top of your raised beds, put a barrier of copper and slugs can't cross over it.
That's what I use. It's very effective.
Yeah, it's great. If you go out at night, you can see them get electrified. They give off a little shock. It's great. You know, the old salt shaker is a great cure, and it's very satisfying to see them shrivel up. You know, you only have to get like one grain of salt on them, and they're doomed. And if, for instance, you're from Philly like I am, you can stand there and taunt them as they're shrinking like the Wicked Witch. And you don't have to worry about salt because your excessive rainfall will keep rinsing it out. I don't like ammonia. I certainly don't like bleach. I wouldn't use vinegar because it's an herbicide. But this might be a case for restrained use of salt being the most effective. You don't want to pick them up and throw them. That gets old real fast.
No.
Okay?
Okay.
I hope I redeemed myself.
Thank you.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you. Good luck.
Our next caller hails from Durham, North Carolina. Tom called in to ask Captain Compost about a backyard experiment with biochar as a soil amendment.
Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, thank you, Tom. How you doing, man?
Really well.
Where is Tom located?
I'm in Durham, North Carolina. You know, we're in Zone 7. I guess my question is more general in nature than pertaining to my garden. I've seen information about biochar / terra preta, which is like an Amazonian soil, and I'm wondering, you know, if you've looked into it at all. I saw some stuff come out of Cornell that seems to say that it would be pretty interesting as a soil amendment.
Well, you know, this is fascinating. I haven't heard anybody mention biochar for a long time. It was a craze between 5 and 10 years ago. And allegedly, biochar, which is burnt wood, charcoal, was found underneath, so to speak, the growing beds in some ancient Aztec civilizations. And people picked up on it from there. If you're like me and you have a wood stove, for instance, and you use it during power failures in the winter, when you clean it out, there's always that one log that didn't turn to powder. And if you want to experiment with biochar, there you go. But I don't see the benefit, especially because its nutrients are lost. They went up in the flames. But I'm not sure how it would help underground, where it would be protected, so to speak, from oxygen and not be very reactive. Now, have you played around with it at all, or you're just bored and looking for something new to do?
Well, yeah, that's you know, it looks like an interesting project to me. And some of the stuff I've seen on YouTube talked about a guy who was using hardwood charcoal that you'd use for, you know, grilling, and impregnating it with water and compost, basically compost tea, as a way to make the charcoal a substrate for additional nutrients, which looked interesting to me.
So
I'm thinking this would be a good thing to do in a bed.
So he's using the naturally occurring holes and crevices in the charcoal to hold nutrients, kind of like perlite does as it loosens the soil in a raised bed garden. I would caution people not to use it in their soil. You never want to put any kind of wood product or dry brown material like leaves incorporated in your soil. But, you know, we're kind of dancing around a technique that I have been using for the past couple years called Hugel culture, which is a discipline of permaculture. And because I live in the woods, there's always rotting limbs and branches and stuff littering the ground. It's material, right? It's active material. It's got biomass. There's got to be a good use for it. And the people who developed Hugel culture found that if you especially choose the really softest of the woods, and you make a layer underneath your raised bed soil, that wood, because it's already half rotten, that's going to continue to deteriorate and eventually become food for your plants slowly over time. And if you're like me and you have taller and taller raised beds every year, it's a great way to use up the space that's right beyond the root zone of the plants. So it's almost like slow release fertilizer. But I would love to hear from people who've actually utilized it, because you haven't done anything with it yet, right?
No.
Yeah.
And let me give it a try.
And you mentioned hardwood charcoal, you know, because one of the big trends also around that time was using wood to grill. You know, you would get the high heat off the, not fresh wood, it would be weathered wood, it would be ready to use, but you'd end up with charcoal in the bottom. And this was at Rodale, and nothing ever got thrown away. I mean, there was no way.
Sure.
So people would try it. But if you're going to, quote, buy charcoal or anything like that, you'd have to get it at a place like Whole Foods, where it wouldn't be impregnated with chemicals or anything like that. But what do you grow mostly?
Tomatoes, peppers, you know, the kind of the classics. So I've got a little bit of time yet to play around with something.
Yeah, I would suggest if you want to have fun and do some citizen science, make some biochar. You know, I like the idea if you have a grill that can accommodate hardwood grilling, there's nothing like it, man. It's better than gas. It's better than charcoal. And then you'd get your own charcoal from it. And plant two Amish paste tomatoes, one with that underneath the root zone and one without. And do that with a couple of your plants and take notes and call us back at the end of the season. You may rejuvenate interest in biochar.
Great. That'd be awesome.
All right, man.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure talking to you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, now's the time for a little break, but don't go anywhere except to refill your nog, and we'll be right back because we have a little lily mystery to solve in this episode's Question of the Week.
Can you expect to hear next week? Hilarity, bad jokes, a small amount of useful information, and me. As long as these bolt cutters keep working. Boy, you know, this station must buy locks by the dozen. I'm Mike McGrath, and that's probably on the next You Bet Your Garden. Maybe. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
Welcome back to the very same Best of Calls episode of You Bet Your Garden, where we're looking back at phone calls throughout 2025 that really jingled our bells, as well as a question of the week directly responding to one of these very calls. So stay with us as we round out the year with our personal favorites. For our final call, Jack was nimble and Jack was quick to call Mike about his soggy peaches in need of properly timed pruning.
Our phone number, 610-694-8100, extension number 3. Jack, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, hello, Mike. So very nice to talk to you, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
Altoona, Pennsylvania, central part of the state.
Yes, I know where that is. And what can we do you for?
Okay. I've got a city plot. I've got two little peach trees planted back there. The soil's kind of wet, so I raised them up about a foot above the stagnant area, but it dries out.
Oh, no. Stop right there. This area is constantly wet?
No, intermittently when it rains, but then it dries out.
Okay.
I've got runoff from the houses above me. So.
Okay. That's a common problem. Take a look at that runoff. Is there any way you can divert it, maybe using gutters or a berm, so it doesn't saturate the area of the peach trees?
I'll put a berm in. I can do that.
Okay. So you got two peach trees.
Yep.
How old?
And they were supposed to be Albertas, but they made white peaches last year, and I probably got 300 to 400 peaches. They're in their third year now, and I pruned them to open center, according to the way Mike Parker does at North Carolina State Extension.
Okay.
And I've been doing dormant oil sprays and trying to spray for insects when the bees aren't flying. So anyway, I talked to the Penn State guys, and I was going to prune them like in February or January last year because I was going out of town, but they said, don't do it because you wait for the buds to swell, but if you prune too early, it stimulates hormones that tell the plant to start growing for 18 days, like in the middle of the winter. So that's why I didn't do it. And I'm also about worried if I prune too early, I have open wounds that maybe will get infected or, you know, harm the tree. So
that's rarely a problem, the open wound issue. But congratulations, Penn State. The same is true in the fall. People who prune fruit trees in the fall stimulate growth, then they get a hard freeze, and it can kill the tree. And obviously the same is going to be true in the spring. You get out there on a nice day, way too early in the season, sun shining, it's 60 degrees, you prune, and the next thing you know, the weather guessers are saying, it's an Arctic blast coming down from Canada. And the sap inside actually freezes and you harm the tree. No, you either prune when the tree is totally dormant and is not going to come out of dormancy, like midwinter, when if nobody wants to do it, that's probably the time to do it. Or when they start growing in the spring. Now, are you going to be gone again this spring?
I'm not planning to, so I should have time to plant it whenever, or prune it whenever you say it's the proper time.
Okay. Here's what I suggest. You wait until the flowers open. You know how beautiful those flowers are, so enjoy that, because you seem to have been very successful with your peaches, which makes you the odd man out. Peaches are probably the hardest thing to grow organically or so-called conventionally. So after the flowers have faded, then I suggest you prune out one-third of the tree, focusing, as you have said, on opening up the center. And then do you thin the fruits as they develop?
I didn't last year, but I will this year.
Yeah. Take off at least every other peach, especially when they're touching each other. And then if the tree starts to get overly lush, prune again, pruning off branches, ideally, that don't have any peaches growing on them or look weak or brittle. Peach trees grow faster than any other fruit tree, and it's imperative to keep airflow in them. Now, you mentioned earlier that you use dormant oil in the winter. Have you had peach tree borer problems?
One of my peach trees was killed 2 years ago by borer, yeah.
Yeah, that's a very common occurrence. All right, I approve of the dormant oil spray. As you move into the season, simply move to a summer spray. Dormant oil is a petroleum product, and it's okay to use. It's fine. It's necessary for the health of the tree. But as you get to the spring, you move to a summer spray, which is based on vegetable oil. It's much lighter and kinder to a growing tree.
Okay.
All right, man. I'm envious of your harvest. You're obviously doing a lot of things right.
It's sheer dumb luck. Everything else it doesn't do so well, but the peaches seem to. So thanks, Mike.
All right. So good luck to you and your peaches, man.
Thanks a million. It's been a wonderful time.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. It is time for the question of the week, which we are calling, What's Up, Tiger Lily? It all began on July 8th when Ronald in Burlington County, New Jersey wrote, My wife and I have been noticing pods hanging on the sides of some of our tiger lilies. We have tried to search them on the web to no avail. Might you or your community know what they are? Well, I studied the photos that Ronald sent and searched the net high and low, but I could not figure out what they were. I suggested they might be some sort of insect egg nest because the plants themselves were totally unharmed and healthy looking, or the kind of gall that wasps induce on oak trees, whose black liquid inside was used for ink in the early Americas. Then I shined the garden signal on the conveniently located clouds above the Bat Cave and asked all of yous for help. The cascade of corrections began on July 25th, the first day we aired the original call. Beverly Phillips, a former Lehigh County master gardener living in neighboring Allentown, PA, immediately wrote to the station. Mike's first caller today spoke about strange black objects on his tiger lily stalks, whose proper genus name is Lilium. This is different from, quote, regular day lilies, whose Latin name is Hemerocallis. The black objects are bulbils, natural formations that disperse themselves and grow into more tiger lilies. They are a means of reproduction, not an insect, disease, or other nefarious attacker. The, quote, Gates residents followed with a photo showing pods that definitely resembled the original photo, adding, quote, those balls are called seeds, using all caps for the word seeds, in case I was hard of hearing. Stone Post Gardens, a plant supplier that specializes in these flowers, addresses the seed question nicely in a Q&A on their website. Question, are bulbils seeds? Answer, no, bulbils contain no seeds. They act as mini bulbs that can grow new cloned plants vegetatively. Second question, do you need bulbils and seeds to get new plants? Answer, no, just bulbils. Tiger lily seeds in pods are another way they reproduce. Thanks to Linda Kay for sending us that link. Then Randy, of no known address, sent us a Gmail showing three photos from his garden. But his bulbils looked nothing like our listeners' photos. His are brown and uneven and attached to the leaves. The ones in our original mystery photo are smooth, black, and mostly on the stems. Judy S. in State College, PA, sent us a link to the lily pad bulb farm that explains the stem versus leaf axle topic. An heirloom favorite, commonly known as the tiger lily, produces a big crop of stem bulbets every year and aerial bulbets that resemble black beads thickly arranged along the stem. Terry in Thompson, Ohio, wrote in favor of my black jelly bean description. Those things on a tiger lily turn shiny and black and eventually fall off the plant to the ground where they grow into new tiger lilies. Adds James M. I was listening to your caller describing the black jelly beans on his tiger lilies. They're bulbils, also called stem bulblets, tiny black seed-like mini-bulbs that form in the leaf axils of tiger lilies. They start to fall off as summer progresses, just like he described. Now, I want to extend my apologies to the many other listeners who contacted us about this issue, but we can't run all your names or there wouldn't be room for anything else in this article. Back to the North Carolina Extension website, who warned that, quote, the bulbils are produced in profusion and this lily can become weedy. The bulbils are the easiest way to propagate this species, but they also help it to, quote, spread aggressively and urge gardeners to, quote, consider planting other lilies, such as the Asiatic hybrids that do not produce bulbils. Now, this is another case where invasive is a matter of opinion. I have had a family of tiger lilies return every summer in the woods just across from our home, and they don't seem to multiply, just return. In addition, their vivid color in July is a welcome sight after the flowers of spring bloomers have faded, and the dried lily flowers are an essential component of traditional hot and sour soup. Just don't eat the flowers raw, only cooked. We now end with, believe it or not, an actual question. A couple of years ago, Barbara in Essex, Maryland, which she notes is near Baltimore, wrote, I will be moving soon and want to take some of my beloved tiger lilies with me. Alas, it is now November, and I won't be able to plant the bulbs until spring. Can I dig the bulbs up now and store them until spring? And what is your best suggestion for storage? Soil or no soil? Well, the absolute best answer would be to collect any bulbils that drop off the plants and store them in a cool, dry spot packed in very slightly moist perlite or milled peat moss. I repeat, slightly moist. Otherwise, dig up the underground bulbs after your first light frost, brush off the dirt, do not wash them, and store as above. As to the title of today's masterpiece, I quote Wikipedia. What's Up, Tiger Lily is a 1966 comedy by Woody Allen that overdubbed a Japanese spy movie with new dialogue. The film follows a secret agent's quest for the world's best egg salad. And that, as they say, is the ever-loving end. Well, that sure was a fun discussion about daylily bulbils, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the top of the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to drown my daylilies if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100 and follow the prompts to You Bet Your Garden. Or, yes, send us your email. You're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse, teeming to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. And if you don't know where you live, ask your neighbor and include that in the email or phone call. And visit our Facebook page, where we are always posting new photos of stuff that looks good in my garden, important and informative updates about the show, a link to the written version of the Gardens Alive question of the week, and links to our priceless podcast, It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he was exposed to the rays from an exploding dwarf star and nothing happened. Our musical director is the unstoppable Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Norfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Ziprote. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome ninja, Sean. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, thanking my peerless producer, James Ziprote, and my awesome assistant, the incredible ninja, Sean, for taking over this week and picking our best of show. I appreciate it, guys, and I'll sleep an extra hour late. And we'll be back next week. Lord knows with who, but we'll be back. You can't keep us away.